This episode is sponsored by World History Encyclopedia, one of the top history websites on the internet. I love the fact they're not a wiki. Every article they publish is reviewed by the editorial team, not only for being accurate, but also for being interesting to read. The website is run as a non-profit organization, so you won't be bombarded by annoying ads, and is completely free. It's a great site, and don't just take my word for it. They've been recommended by many academic institutions, including Oxford University. Go check them out at worldhistory.org or follow the link in the episode description. In 1994, the still controversial figure Yasser Arafat received the Nobel Peace Prize. Viewed by many Palestinians, Arabs, and some in other countries as a heroic freedom fighter for the Palestinians, he was dismissed largely in Israel and in some parts of the Western world as a terrorist. It was an award he shared with two Israelis, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. The award was recognition for their combined efforts to find a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians, results that had culminated in the US-brokered Oslo Accords. After decades of violence, the Middle East was finally on the verge of lasting peace.
The Palestinian people stand at a crossroads. Behind you, a history of dispossession and dispersal. Before you, the opportunity to shape a new Palestinian future on your own land.
But 30 years later, peace has never seemed further away.
The horrors that Hamas perpetrated on October 7th remind us that we will not realize the promise of a better future unless we, the civilized world, are willing to fight the barbarians.
Rape, beheadings, bodies burned alive. Hamas committed atrocities that recall the worst ravages of ISIS.
Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease.
In this episode, I speak with a Middle Eastern policy and strategy expert, Dr. Stephen Zunas, a professor from the University of San Francisco. We discuss the current and ongoing situation in Israel and Palestine, how we got here, the US's role, and where we go from here. Stephen, I was a teenager in England back in the 90s when the Clinton administration had these dual peace plans, one for Northern Ireland, one for Israel. Both seemed to have insurmountable problems. The Clinton administration got involved. We had people who'd been dismissed as terrorists. Other people viewed them as freedom fighters, sitting down with governments. Deals were made. The one in Northern Ireland, while imperfect, has proven to be quite durable. The Oslo Accords involving Israel and the Palestinians seems to have unraveled almost immediately. What was the reason for that?
Part of it had to do with the fact that the Oslo Accords were rather vague on certain areas, and the Israelis, as the more powerful of the two parties, and with the backing of the United States, which had claimed the mantle of the chief mediator in the conflict, were able to take advantage of that. For example, Israel was allowed to continue to expand the settlements, whereas the Palestinians, when they said neither party will take unilateral actions to alter the status of the territory, they had assumed that that meant a settlements freeze. It became also clear that the idea of a Palestinian self-determination would not necessarily mean full sovereign statehood. And when it became more and more apparent that a Palestine Authority had been outmaneuvered, and when they took over the leadership in Jericho and Ramallah and some of the other cities, it proved to be rather corrupt. And that led to more skepticism and resentment. I mean, the idea and theory of Oslo was that more Palestinian rights and sovereignty would lead to more moderation and less violence. Therefore, the Israelis would be more confident to give the Palestinians still more land and autonomy, which would in turn lead to greater moderation and be a positive feedback loop. But instead, it ended up being the opposite, because the Palestinians were not getting the kind of progress towards statehood that they expected, and that therefore increased the support for Hamas and extremist organizations, which engaged in terrorism, which gave the Israelis the excuse to give up even less, which then led to more resentment. Hamas went from like 15% support back in 1993 to like 45% support in the parliamentary elections in 2005, which they ended up essentially getting a majority of the Palestinian parliament. And so they had a kind of almost a French-style cohabitation, you know, where one party had the parliament, Fatah, the more moderates had the executive. But then the Bush administration pushed Fatah to stage a coup to get rid of Hamas. They got wind of it, attempted a counter coup. You had this little three-day civil war. And when the smoke cleared, Fatah had firm control of the urban areas of the West Bank, where Israel had allowed some degree of autonomy, and Hamas ended up seizing the Gaza Strip.
With regard to the Israeli settlers in the Palestinian territories, are these people that are simply just trying to move there to drive out the Palestinians for reasons of gaining territory, or are these just deeply religious people who say, hey, the Bible says this is our promised land, so we really have no option other than to go there because this is what God wants?
A lot of the settlers, nearly half, are these ideologues. These are Jewish fundamentalists who say that God promised us this land in the 15th chapter of Genesis, end of story. That the Torah trumps anything to do with international law or precedent or anything else. But you also have more secular right-wingers in Israel, which kind of take this victor's justice attitude. Well, we seize this land, and therefore we should be able to keep it. Most of the West Bank is actually pretty fertile, has a big aquifer. It has the strategic high ground and, you know, all this kind of thing. Ultimately, let's be honest, it is built on a certain racist ideology that Israeli Jews have more rights than the indigenous Palestinian Arab population. This is a direct violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits any country from populating territories seized by military force with its civilian population. And its application to the West Bank has been confirmed in no less than 5 UN Security Council resolutions, as well as a advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice. Israel knows that the United States will block any effort to enforce these Security Council resolutions or other aspects of international law, and that it will continue to take the position that issues like the settlements and the exact boundaries of a new Palestinian state or whatever can only come through the bilateral negotiations between the two parties, meaning not the United Nations, not through pressure by the United States, such as conditioning military aid or whatever, but simply bilateral negotiations between the two parties. The problem with that, of course, is that even if you assume, as I do, that Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have equal rights to statehood, to self-determination, to peace and security, and cultural and religious and civil rights, etc., it ignores the gross asymmetry in power between the occupier and those under occupation. I mean, when Iraq seized Kuwait in 1990, we didn't say, oh, you two work it out among yourselves about how much autonomy Kuwait will be able to have, how much land Iraq will be able to keep. No, the international community took a very, very firm line. No, you cannot expand your territory by force, period.
After the October 7th attacks, most countries condemned those and stood behind Israel. But since then, due to Israel's level of, you know, recriminations, bombings in Palestinian, a lot of countries have come out in criticism of Israel, including South Africa, who took Israel to court, accusing it of war crimes. The United States, though, for the most part, has remained steadfast behind Israel, even when there have been instances of civilians, aid workers, and so forth having been killed. What is the rationale behind the American stance? Is it just based on the history of the Holocaust and what happened then, and trying to make sure something like that never occurs again, that Israel will always be, in a sense, in the right when it comes to a conflict from a U.S. standpoint? And if that is the case, I mean, what's the logic in that, and how do we rationalize that compared with other conflicts?
You have this older generation of, you know, liberals and social democrats in the United States, you know, do see Israel as a legitimate national liberation struggle for historically oppressed people. They have this almost romantic attachment, you know, of Israel in its progressive heyday, you know, with being a social democracy, socialist collectives, the kibbutzim, and rights for women, and all these cool things in the background of a pretty reactionary, patriarchal, autocratic, you know, Arab Middle East. A lot of the criticism of Israel was hypocritical, and anti-Semitism was involved. And so there's a kind of defensiveness about it. Despite Israel going way to the right and the Arab states moderating their views and the PLO moderating its views, they still see Israel in this regard. Joe Biden and the congressional leadership are of that generation that really do have that kind of idealistic view. And on the right, you have the right-wing Christian fundamentalists, these Protestant evangelicals who see Israel as fulfillment of biblical prophecy. They see Israel versus Palestine like Israelites and the Philistine, and we know whose side God is on. They see God as some kind of cosmic real estate agent who says, hey, this belongs to Israel, end of story. Again, like the Jewish fundamentalists to settlers. And they essentially dominate the Republican Party for all intents and purposes. So those are ideological factors, but the main factor is strategic, like it was in the Cold War. Indeed, much of the support for U.S. allies and hostility towards certain left-leaning Arab nations and other elsewhere in the global South was less about the Soviets as much as it was any kind of independent nationalism that was kind of outside of the neoliberal Western imperatives. And Israel still plays a strategic value today because Arab allies could be overthrown in a revolution or a coup. But Israel's there to stay. They are, in the words of one former Secretary of State, our unsinkable aircraft carrier. Joe Biden, as a senator, and he repeated this a couple times as president, he said, if it weren't for an Israel, we'd have to invent them. Because Israel looks after strategic interests in the Middle East. As in the Cold War, battlefield testing for American weapons. They've trained U.S. soldiers in counterterrorism and counterinsurgencies. They funneled arms. They've supported pro-Western governments and insurgencies. They have funneled U.S. arms to third parties that U.S. couldn't give directly to for political reasons. Back in the Cold War, it was like apartheid South Africa, Guatemalan junta, the Nicaraguan Contras. More recently, it's been various Kurdish militia, Colombian paramilitaries. Mossad and CIA collaborate on intelligence gathering and covert operations. The military-industrial complexes of the two countries are very closely intertwined. So, you know, there are all sorts of strategic rationales for keeping that close relationship. Now, there are some folks, some of the neorealists and a few State Department veterans that are saying, well, you know, this is actually hurting our interest in the long run because it's encouraging extremism, you know, getting all these 1.5 billion Muslims hate us. It makes us look very hypocritical when it comes to Ukraine or non-proliferation issues or other things when we say one country can't do something, but then we let Israel get away with the same thing. I mean, there are definitely arguments against the strategic rationale. There are arguments against the liberal or even the theological rationales. But, you know, the dominant one still is very much that Israel, as in the Cold War, still serves U.S. strategic interest in this very important region. You know, Biden continually rules out using aid or anything as pressure, which is ironic because we've had other presidents, Eisenhower, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, you know, who have forced Israel to stop military offensives by threatening to withhold aid, as recently as Obama, actually. But Biden refuses to even consider that. This could cost him the election, actually, because American public opinion, vast majority of Americans believe there should be a ceasefire, even a bigger number if you look at Democrats, among young people in particular. I mean, more young people oppose Biden on Gaza than they did a Bush on Iraq, Reagan in Central America, or even Nixon on Vietnam. You know, this could impact turnout, where youth turnout, minority turnout is critical for Democratic victories, but youth minority voters are just really, really angry at Biden over this. And like Humphrey in 68 and Kerry in 2004, when the Democratic nominee supports an unpopular war, they tend to lose close elections to flawed Republican candidates. He's getting pressure even from career State Department people and very mainstream people, not just the peace and human rights community. Of course, Trump is a total ideologue. I mean, he and Jared Kushner are ready to let the Israelis totally ethnically cleanse the area and set up Israeli resorts on the Mediterranean. But, you know, it's pretty discouraging, frankly. I mean, I've never seen such a big gap on hardly any issue as you do around U.S. public opinion and policy. In many ways, this is part of a broader crisis in American democracy that we tend to see even more in foreign policy than domestic policy. And it's alienating a whole young generation, radicalizing them in many ways.
When Israel responded, Netanyahu said that he wanted to wipe out Hamas. And there was a lot of discussion about going after the Hamas fighters. It seems to me as if there's this perception as if there's just a finite number of terrorists who are in Hamas. Whereas I should imagine that if, say, you are not in Hamas today and your brother is, and your brother suddenly gets killed, you might find his rifle and suddenly want to pick it up, get revenge, and now you are a de facto Hamas member. Or indeed, you know, if you've got children whose homes have been destroyed, parents have been killed, and they're orphans, isn't there a danger that now these are people who may well be receptive to a terrorist message going forward, whether that is one from Hamas or some other kind of group that springs up in the aftermath of this crisis?
Well, very much so. In fact, if you look at recent histories of countries invading other countries with high civilian casualties in the name of fighting terrorism, it's only created more terrorists. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan to wipe out the terrorist Mujahideen, it led directly to the rise of the Taliban. When Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 to go after the terrorist PLO, it led directly to the rise of Hezbollah. And of course, when the United States and Britain invaded Iraq in the name of the war on terrorism, it led directly to the rise of ISIS. And so even putting aside the moral and legal questions against Israel's war in Gaza, on a very practical level, it's not the way to stop terrorism. Using terror to fight terrorism creates more terrorists. I mean, one could sort of say the Israelis were so traumatized by October 7th and Netanyahu is such an ideologue, you could kind of expect that. But you kind of think the United States, having witnessed these other things, wouldn't buy into this argument that somehow a military solution to this conflict.
Before October 7th, Netanyahu was facing mass demonstrations at home from Israelis who were dissatisfied with his government. But now that we are in this conflict, is this something that could actually be beneficial to him, both in the sense that, you know, they may not want to change governments and have instability during wartime, but also if this conflict goes on, you know, if he can position himself as this, you know, wartime leader, it could help him to just cling on to power, and the protests we saw beforehand could evaporate.
Well, his popularity has plummeted. He is already a very controversial leader, as you mentioned, with his massive demonstrations against his attempted judicial coup. But people are pretty upset at him about what happened on October 7th. I mean, his big campaign thing was that was on Trump style, only I can protect you. And of course, Israelis are much more concerned about protection security than Americans are. Not only was there a huge intelligence failure, but Netanyahu had sent no less than 32 Israeli brigades outside of Israel, including the Gaza Brigade, supposed to be guarding the border, to bring them into the West Bank to support these far-right settlers, suppress the Palestinian population and bulldoze homes and, you know, expand the Israeli settlements and that kind of thing. So if the election were held today, you know, Netanyahu would lose big time. But at the same time, there's not going to be an election while a war is going on. And so some people speculated that that's one reason he wants the war to continue, despite all the death and destruction of Palestinians, despite the threat on the remaining hostages, and despite Israeli soldiers that are getting killed. I don't think he can actually go on for years. One thing I want to kind of caution about, because you hear this a lot, and there's this kind of the sense of, in certain liberal opinion in the West, the problem is Netanyahu. And if we just get rid of Netanyahu, we can have peace. We can make progress towards a two-state solution, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, it's true that Netanyahu is categorically ruled out any kind of two-state solution. But the fact is that there's no conceivable coalition government that could come to power in Israel at this point that would be open to a two-state solution as well. In fact, just a few weeks ago, the Israeli Knesset, I think 99 out of 120 members, went on record opposing Palestinian statehood. Netanyahu's a easy foil for all sorts of a reason. He's horrible. He's a war criminal. He's a crook. He's authoritarian-minded. He's all these things. But unfortunately, the problem is more than Netanyahu.
Prior to this current situation, there had been progress made towards rehabilitating Israel in the sense of its relations with other Arab neighbors. Is that process off now because of this?
Certainly, and this seemed to be the direction that things were going prior to October. Indeed, that might have even been part of the motivation of Hamas to do what it did. But right now, Arab public opinion is just so horrified. The tens of thousands of civilian deaths and the total destruction, and just even these more authoritarian states could not get away at this point with normalizing relationships with Israel, having any kind of real security agreement and things like that. I mean, there have been concerns about, especially at the beginning of a possible wider war, the United States sending two carrier groups into the region and you know, thinking of Iran and its proxies. I was never that concerned about that, frankly, because, yeah, Hezbollah will fire in a few rockets in a show of solidarity. The Houthis will try to disrupt shipping in the Red Sea. But nobody, especially Iran, wants a full-scale war because they know, for one thing, Israel could kick their butts in terms of their political advantage. They can just sit back and watch things unfold because this war is radicalizing the entire Middle East, the entire Islamic world. And so if you're a hardline group, you know, whether you be a Shia or you be Sunni, you just sit back and reap the benefits while Israel and the United States become more and more isolated, more and more hated, you know, less and less trusted, possibilities of Arab and Muslim states, you know, being part of some U.S.-Israeli strategic nexus becomes less and less probable.
I want to ask you about another conflict that you are well-researched in and have covered extensively, which is in Western Sahara, where back in the 40-plus years ago, the Moroccan government invaded this sovereign state as recognized by the UN international community. They've been occupying it since, and yet the Trump administration decided to unilaterally recognize Western Sahara as part of Morocco in exchange for Morocco agreeing to have relations with Israel. Is a peace agreement such as that really worth the paper it's written on if we're essentially blackmailing Morocco saying, hey, we'll let you occupy a country if you recognize Israel? And what kind of message does that send to other countries when we essentially hand over Western Sahara and say, hey, they're all yours. And then you look at situations like in former Yugoslavia or in Ukraine. I mean, doesn't that make us seem hugely hypocritical?
Formal recognition was a really big step. No country had done that before. In fact, no country has done that since, except for Israel. It really puts us in a bad hypocritical spot when we say to Russia, you cannot expand territory by force. You can't unilaterally change international boundaries. When the United States has recognized Morocco doing the exact same thing without an act of self-determination by the people of Western Sahara, as the United Nations has repeatedly said, both the Security Council and General Assembly, while the International Court of Justice says. Trump's whole approach to foreign policy was purely transactional. He has had as many conservative critics over his decision to recognize Morocco's annexation as he had more left-leaning critics. Yeah, the whole approach, I'd say, around the Abraham Accords, which the Biden administration and Congress has, you know, ironically upheld and encouraged, even though it was put together by Jared Kushner, of all people, that, you know, the way to peace is for Israel to have normal relations with these authoritarian Arab states. Ever since 2002, every single member of the Arab League has been on record saying that they are willing to recognize Israel and live in peace and have normal relations if Israel withdraws from the occupied territories. Recognition is the one leverage that the Palestinians have. And so this push to unilaterally get Arab countries to recognize Israel, as Trump and now Biden is doing, is basically trying to have the Palestinians lose this one bit of leverage they have left to have a sovereign state. But the only countries that have agreed to this so far have been Bahrain and United Arab Emirates, these tiny oil-rich sheikhdoms, which have never been at war with Israel. And that was in return for some big arms package. Sudan is under a brutal military junta. That was in return for lifting sanctions related to their collaboration with al-Qaeda back in the 1990s. Sudan had never been at war with Israel either. And then Morocco, which had sent a couple of brigades to support some of the Arab states in the 73 war, but they had quietly had relationships with Israel for decades. So the idea this is a peace agreement in the first place is pretty ludicrous. The thing in Morocco was such a dangerous precedent. Morocco is less willing to negotiate freedom and give the people of Western Sahara, who are, you know, linguistically, culturally, you know, very different than the Moroccans. I mean, you know, they're technically both Arabs, but they speak a totally different dialect, a very different kinship system, and very different people. To deny them this right of self-determination. And here's the irony, you know, the U.S. position is that we cannot push Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories because the Palestinian leadership is divided. In addition to Fatah and the PLO and the Palestine Authority, you have Hamas, you have Islamic Jihad, you have the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. There's other groups engaged in terrorism. Other groups haven't recognized Israel's right to exist. And none of those groups are democratic. But then you look at Western Sahara. They don't have a divided leadership. Polisario is a unified, recognized representatives. And there are certainly dissent about particular policies, but virtually all the Sahrawis recognize that as their government, their representative. They've never engaged in terrorism. They've never questioned Morocco's right to exist. And they actually have democratic elections for their president, for their parliament, and everything else. And so the message that the United States has given to the world is that, you know, to the Palestinians, for example, even if you do everything right, we're still not going to recognize your right of self-determination. We will still ally with the occupying power if they're seen as a strategic ally.
At the start of the episode, we talked about the Oslo Accords 30 years ago and how that seemed at the time to be the brink of peace. Are we now at a point with this that peace just seems impossible?
I don't think the October terrorist attacks and the disproportionate Israeli response has necessarily been a factor that would make it impossible, and only because I think things were heading that direction already. For decades, the Palestine Authority, the PLO, and Fatah have said, we're open to a two-state solution. We're open to accepting only 22% of historic Palestine. No full-scale right of return for refugees. Security guarantees, I mean, pretty much everything that Israel, back under its more moderate leadership, had asked for. But the Israelis insisted on incorporating these big settlement blocks. I mean, despite the rewriting of history that Prime Minister Barak gave the Palestinians everything they wanted in 2000 but rejected it. No, if you look at actual proposal, it would have allowed Israel to annex huge swaths of West Bank territory, would have divided the West Bank into four non-contiguous cantons surrounded by Israel, controlling the movement of the people and goods, the airspace, the water resources. I mean, it was further than any Israeli government has gone before or since, but it was short of what they required to do under international law and the minimum that any Palestinian authority that had any credibility could accept. Since then, in part because the United States pushed the myth that Israel had given everything they wanted and the Palestinians weren't interested in peace, Israeli opinion has gone more and more to the right. Also demographically, the more liberal, left-leaning, secular Israelis tend to have small families, the more right-wing, religious, nationalist Israelis have big families. In a small country like that, it doesn't take long before things shift. And not every child takes the same politics of their parents, but on average, they do. And to top it off, you know, a lot of, you know, left-wing Israelis, the adult children have emigrated to Europe at this point because things are getting so bad inside Israel. I mean, and in many ways, things are the opposite of the way things were, you know, 50 years ago. It's the Palestinians and the Arabs are the moderates that are willing to live in peace with Israel. It's the Israelis that are refusing to compromise. Yet the policies of the United States and to a lesser extent other Western countries hasn't changed. The U.S. is still supporting Israel to the hilt. The United States, even before October, I was saying that the U.S. doesn't really support a two-state solution. We say we do, yet we say we're not going to allow the United Nations to pressure Israel. We're not going to pressure Israel through arms shipments or anything. We recognize Israel, but we don't recognize the state of Palestine. We'll encourage other countries to unilaterally recognize Israel, but we'll pull out of any UN agency that recognizes Palestine. And we'll even oppose nonviolent means of advocacy, like boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. We'll only accept a two-state solution under Israeli terms that they voluntarily agreed to, even though for years we've had governments saying that we're not going to accept any kind of Palestinian state. And so the two-state solution has kind of gone from the slogan, the view of progressives and doves and peace advocates, to those Western governments that frankly have no intention on allowing for a two-state solution to happen. And meanwhile, many, many people who have supported a two-state solution for many decades are starting to think it's too late. I mean, you go to the West Bank, you see all these settlements. I mean, the demographics just, they've surrounded all the cities in terms of the electoral system. There's no way that Israel's going to say all you folks have to become Palestinian citizens. You have to move back to Israel. That, you know, more and more people are saying we need to even stop pretending there's a two-state solution. We need to go from an anti-occupation struggle to an anti-apartheid struggle. And this is not because a lot of these people have suddenly become more militant or hardline or suddenly become anti-Zionist or, you know, whatever. It's just sort of a reflection of the reality. Now, you can also argue, well, if Israel's not willing to give up 22% of Palestine, they're not going to give up all of it, you know, in terms of a democratic, secular, or binational state or whatever. But really, I've never been more pessimistic about the possibilities of sustainable peace. But I was that way already before October 7th.
Stephen, thank you so much for your insights. Unfortunately, I share your pessimism, but hopefully we're both wrong. But we shall see. And in the next episode, we head to Gabon in Western Africa and the search for the legacy, the iconic Dr. Albert Schweitzer.